Okay, tonight, if my notes are correct, we broke off the last time in the end of chapter 12. We had chapter 10 and 11 and the brief psalm that makes up chapter 12. And so we're in Isaiah chapter 13, and probably we'll get into part of 14. Isaiah is a fun guy. He has such variety. There's the dirge of judgment one moment and then an incredible messianic glimpse the next. Chapter 13 and 14 are also embody some surprises of sorts, of a very different kind. I believe that I assigned as homework, for those of you that were inclined to take on an assignment, the reading of three pairs of chapters, which if you haven't done, let me have you annotate that now. Now, by the way, if you're those who are taking notes, know that a Chuck Missler Bible study, Acts 17:11, goes in the upper right-hand corner. Acts 17:11 is where Luke tells you not to believe anything Chuck Missler tells you, but to check it out for yourself, in effect. So that certainly applies tonight because we're going to go out into some, you know, pretty strange territory. Chapter 13 deals with the city of Babylon. In fact, I should say more precisely, the Babylonian Empire, not just the city, but in the context of the Babylonian Empire. And this is a widely misunderstood chapter. What I would like you to do if you haven't done it, and we obviously won't cover it all tonight, those of you that are serious about your learning the Bible, I encourage you at one sitting, not in pieces, in one sitting, I'd like you to read six chapters. Take you 20 minutes probably. I'd like you to read Isaiah 13 and 14. People winced at that. I guess you have to read as fast as I talk, huh? Yeah. Several people have complained about my speaking too slowly, but... No? Okay. Isaiah 13 and 14 are the first pair of chapters. Jeremiah 50 and 51 are the second pair of chapters. And Revelation 17 and 18 being the third pair. In other words, six chapters, but in three pairs. But read them all at one sitting, because there's something that you will gain that way that will be far more profound than my sort of summarizing it for you. What you will experience is, on the one hand, the clear perception that all six chapters are talking about the literal city of Babylon. Not Rome, exactly. The city of Babylon, the pride of the Chaldeans, a city in the plain of Shinar. A literal city of Babylon. The idioms of all six chapters, it pervades all six chapters. And so we must be careful not to allegorize Babylon. We're talking a literal Babylon. On the one hand. On the other hand, especially in the Revelation passages, there's something else going on, far more profound than just the city of Babylon, something else. And you need to savor that for yourself and come to your own inferences and conclusions. And we'll talk about some of that at the end, but just to give you a prelude of what that's why I want you to read all six at one sitting. So the voice of each of those three writers, Isaiah and Jeremiah and John, will be in your ear so you can see the consistency of idiom. And there's many issues there. But we're going to jump into Isaiah 13 and part of 14 tonight. And as we do, I want to anticipate some of the key points to be on the alert for. History talks about the fall of Babylon, meaning the fall of the Babylonian Empire. The city of Babylon is going to rise to power and decline. And we have the famous fall of Babylon. The Bible talks about the destruction of Babylon, and 9 out of 10 commentators confuse the two. That is, think they're the same thing. For a number of reasons that will emerge from this study tonight, you'll discover that this has a lot to do with Saddam Hussein, the Persian Gulf crisis so far, and it's not over yet, and what's going to be unfolding over the next few months, few years, whatever. And I'm going to suggest to you that CNN and the other media have no idea what's going on. And you will, if you understand what the Bible says about the city of Babylon. The issue is not Baghdad, it's 62 miles south, to something the commentators haven't even mentioned. And we'll see why as we go. Isaiah has been talking so far, in the judgments we've read in chapters 10 and so on, of the Assyrian Empire. Reigned over the earth for 700 years. Capital was Nineveh. And at the time that Isaiah was writing, Assyria captured the northern kingdom of Israel, the house of Israel, in contrast to Judah that Isaiah is focusing on. And the Assyrian threat terrified Judah. And so Isaiah had two burdens. On the one hand, to describe that God would be using Assyria to judge the northern kingdom, but also to give them comfort that despite the threat, that Assyria was not to conquer the southern kingdom. And we saw that very dramatically in chapter 10 and so on last time. What's strange about Isaiah focusing on the destruction of Babylon, which he's about to, is that the time Isaiah's writing, Babylon hadn't even risen to a power yet. He wrote about 100 years before all that happened. The Assyrian Empire conquered the northern kingdom on about 722 BC. Nebuchadnezzar makes his famous rise, the Battle of Carchemish, at 606 BC. In other words, over 100 years later. You follow me? So it's interesting. I want you to be sensitive to the burden of Isaiah's readers, because he's talking about a destruction of something that hasn't grown big enough to destruct. You follow me? The time Isaiah's writing, Babylon is a pawn of Assyrian politics. It's a city down south, southern, lower Mesopotamia, what you and I would call southern Iraq, as opposed to Nineveh, which would be up in the northern part of Iraq or Syria, depending on how you cut things. So, the city of Babylon. Now, the point that I'm going to make, though, by the way, is that the language here goes far beyond that which not only Isaiah and his followers, but also modern commentators have perceived. But before we get into that, let me also talk a little bit about ancient Babylon, because you and I can't help but have rather quaint ideas about what Babylon really was all about. Babylon at its peak, ancient Babylon at its peak, was a city roughly, not quite square, roughly rectangular, over 15 miles on a side. It was cut in, not quite in half, by the river Euphrates. Not quite diagonally, not quite in half, but sort of a little, from slightly northwest entry and exit, slightly east of south. In other words, cutting through the rectangular city. It had double walls, and as the river went through the city, it also was diverted to fill a moat. Okay? That was a primary defense. But let's talk about this wall. Herodotus tells us it was 350 feet high at its highest points, 87 feet thick. They used to race 6 chariots abreast. So that's, you know, when you think of an ancient city, we often think of the ruins, the quaint ruins that we visit in the Middle East. Or Babylon it was the world empire. 250 towers, some of them 100 feet higher than the wall. And, of course, had several temples, the Tower of Bel, which is Akkadian for Baal, as we know it in the Old Testament, and Marduk or Merodach, if you will, from the Old Testament. The palace of Nebuchadnezzar, they have uncovered and incidentally rebuilt. It had a courtyard that's virtually 200 feet by 170 feet. That's a large courtyard by today's standards. And I know you're saying real estate was cheaper then. Okay, but the throne room of Nebuchadnezzar was, as they found, and since has been reconstructed, is 165 feet long and 143 feet wide. And the very room that the famous handwriting on the wall has been built today, and Saddam Hussein, at least prior to the 100-hour war, used to use it for affairs of state. There's a major receptions there in 87 and so on. And, of course, there's several key towers, the Tower of Esagelia, which is the house of him whose head is raised up, and also the Tower of Ektamani Anke, which we sometimes think is a vestige, if you will, of the Tower of Babel of Genesis 11, the home of the foundation of the heaven and the earth. And you know the story. The thing you should also do, and I won't get into tonight in the interest of time, is to understand Babylon's origin. Genesis 10, the first world dictator, who I believe scholars believe was a black man, by the way, in deference to our guest. Nimrod, first world dictator, founded several cities, and of course, Babylon being one of them, or Babel. And the Tower of Babel and the whole narrative in Genesis 11 starts a history of a city who spiritually symbolizes the city of man, or if you will, the city of Satan. And while Babylon has its ups and downs, its spiritual role is unchanged. It is the city of man. And you can talk, there's another city that emerges in Genesis 14. Very early, just a hint, but it starts there, a city called Jerusalem. Melchizedek is the first place, first one that appears there. The city of Jerusalem emerges in the scripture in early Genesis. And the story in the entire Bible can be viewed as a tale of two cities. The city of man, Babylon, and the city of God, Jerusalem. Now don't misunderstand. Both cities have their ups and downs. And we're not here to extol Jerusalem, other than its role in the Bible spiritually is in the city of God. And both of them start in Genesis. Both of them are climaxed in Revelation. Babylon being judged and the Jerusalem being replaced by the heavenly Jerusalem, which is a whole other study, of course. But the point is, the Scripture almost uses these two cities symbolically, antithetically, one to another. Well, let's jump in and let's untangle a little bit about what we know about Babylon. Isaiah chapter 13, verse 1, the burden of Babylon, the masa, the burden. We still use that term today, heavy, right? You know what I mean, right? Well, that's what Isaiah is saying. This is heavy. It's the burden of Babylon. It's not extolling or exalting or raising up. It's the burden of Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amoz did see. And again, this is not Amos the prophet, different Amoz, total different spelling in the Hebrew, both first and last letters are different. So don't confuse Amoz, the father of Isaiah, has nothing to do with Amos the prophet. In fact, they're opposite in many ways. Amos was a man of the field, rural. Isaiah was a man of the court, and so on. Verse 2, lift ye up a banner upon the high mountain, exalt the voice unto them, shake the hand, that they may go into the gates of the nobles. I have commanded my sanctified ones. I have also called my mighty ones for mine anger, even them that rejoice in my highness. Well, we don't have to untangle that phrase very much to say that if this is God speaking, something ominous is about to happen. I have commanded my sanctified ones, whoever they are. I have also called my mighty ones to minister, to comfort. No, for mine anger. You know, we glibly use these words. The idea of God being angry is a little terrifying. Even them that rejoice in my highness. So something's about to spring, and it's far more than some local political uprising or downfalling or whatever. Verse 4, the noise of a multitude in the mountains as of a great people. A tumultuous noise of the kingdoms of nations gathered together. Wait a minute, friends. Kingdoms of nations. Already, to the extent we know something about Babylon, this doesn't quite fit. Let me pause. Somewhere in here I need to pause, and I'll just choose arbitrarily right now to talk, get to remind you a little bit of the history of Babylon. Babylon was a city-state of Assyria. Along the way, a guy emerges. His father is appointed king of the city of Babylon, and this young guy is the father's general. The young guy's name is Nebuchadnezzar. He and his father, incidentally, emerged from a land which is called in the ancient nomenclature the Sea Lands, the marshlands of the south. If you look at a map and look at where Babylon was, what was to the south? A place you and I would call Kuwait, interestingly enough. There are several things that emerge out of Kuwait. Nebuchadnezzar and his father, who will be prominent in our tale in a moment, being one of them, or a couple of them. There's also a guy that emerged in that area from the tribe of Kedar, the second son of Ishmael, by the name of Muhammad, who in the 600s gave us Islam. And we'll hear a lot more about those 2 billion members of Islam before history plays out much further. And a third character that surfaces on the scene, not in that class, don't misunderstand me, but still it's interesting to notice that another guy that emerged out of the tribe of Kedar that originated in Kuwait was a guy by the name of Saddam Hussein. And so that's kind of interesting. The tale thickens, huh? Yes. Okay, so Babylon starts to rise. Nebuchadnezzar's generalship is excellent. He knocks over a few other cities. The two main powers left on his horizon at the time as he rises, this is about a century after Isaiah's writing, this is in the 606 B.C. that I'm leading up to rather than 722 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar conquers not only the Assyrians, but also at the time, which was also rising to power, the Egyptians. And there is a very key battle in ancient history known as the Battle of Carchemish, 606 B.C., where Nebuchadnezzar defeats Pharaoh Necho, and that battle is the sort of the milestone that establishes Babylon as the dominant world empire. It rises to power. And Nebuchadnezzar not only defeats Pharaoh Necho, he also lays siege to Jerusalem, the first siege of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, the prophets had been predicting, and I'm not just talking about Isaiah, primarily Jeremiah and Ezekiel, had told Israel, I should say Judah, the southern kingdom. Israel had long been captured. The southern kingdom, kingdom of Judah, that God was going to judge them too, just like their northern neighbors. The northern neighbors went into idolatry. God judged them. Judah didn't learn the lesson. The prophets preached. They wouldn't listen. They also going to idolatry. God decides to judge them. The reason he judges them is also kind of interesting. Among the many violations that Judah did not keep the law, they did not obey God. Among the things that they did not obey is they did not keep the Sabbath of the land. You and I know the Sabbath of the week, the Sabbath for man. 6 days you work, the seventh you rest. That was the Sabbath week for man, the Sabbath for man. There was also a Sabbath for the land. 6 years you plowed the land, the seventh year you let it lie. And they were supposed to do that. They didn't do that. They didn't do that for 490 years. And God says, you owe me 70. So you're going to go into slavery into Babylon for 70 years. And the first siege of Nebuchadnezzar starts a period of time called the servitude of the nation, where the nation Israel is enslaved to Babylon for 70 years. And by the way, they are enslaved to Babylon for 70 years to the very day, which is kind of interesting. But that's just, we're just getting warmed up here. Nebuchadnezzar finds out that his father's died, so he goes back to Babylon, not just as general, but now as king. Young guy, inherits the old court guard, and what he does in Jerusalem, he captures Jerusalem, but he puts in a vassal king, Jehoiakim, and he takes some hostages. He cherry picks the best young men for postgraduate school to serve at the Babylonian court, and that's where Daniel and his three friends are included. And I believe Ezekiel at that time was also enslaved. There was a number that he took, including the temple vessels. He puts those in his museum. Just north of his palace, there's a museum. He was accustomed to taking those artifacts of his captured peoples and displaying them in the museum, and he does that. And they'll appear in our tale in a few moments. When he gets back home, he inherits this palace guard, he has a problem. He doesn't know if these guys can cut it or not, these old men that served his father. Who are they? Nebuchadnezzar has a dream one night that really bothers him. Strange dream. So the next morning, he calls all his advisors together and says, I want you guys to interpret my dream for me. And by the way, to see if you guys can cut the mustard, I want you to tell me what the dream was and what it means. Well, they don't particularly relate to that. Because that's not the way it works, king. Well, you tell us your dream and we'll interpret it for you. We have people like that today that'll run their meter and tell you what your dreams mean. Probably just as effective, I don't know. Anyway, so the king says, no, you don't understand my professional development program. If you don't tell me what the dream was and what it means, you're going to be all killed. He explained it to him a little more clearly. I think the actual King James says, I'll tear you limb from limb and make your houses a dunghill, or words to that effect. So they say, no man on earth can do what you're asking, and they're right, by the way. And Nebuchadnezzar says, no problem, you know, off with their head, in effect. Daniel happens to be in that job description. So when the word comes out that particular classification of employment has just been eliminated, very literally, Daniel says, wait a minute, time out, boss. Give me an audience to the king, and we'll give him the answer he wants. Now, that's guts. I don't know how many of you have that much confidence in prayer as Daniel did, but he called his buddies together and says, hey, let's have a prayer meeting. And he and his three friends pray. And when they get the audience to the king, Daniel reveals what the prayer was, and what it means. That's all in Daniel chapter 2, and I'm obviously being rather cavalier in my summary of it. But by the way, we won't take the time to go into detail because it reads like a shooting script. It's incredibly, the first six chapters of Daniel are the narrative of his incredible life, and the last six are various visions he had. And I commend that to your study. He was a teenager, deported, very bright, very faithful to the God of Israel. What makes Daniel chapter 2 so valuable to us, it's one of those rare places, there's only a few in the Bible, where God gives us an overview of Gentile history. Most of Bible prophecy is about how things impact God's chosen people, the nation Israel. You normally see the Gentile world only as it impinges on Israel, but Daniel chapter 2 and chapter 7 and a few other places are exceptions. Daniel chapter 2, this dream that Nebuchadnezzar has, lays out all of world history from Nebuchadnezzar until God sets up his own government on the earth. Fascinating chapter. Something you must, if you're serious about Bible study, you need to study that. We'll move on. Incidentally, Daniel's a teenager in chapter 2. Late in his life, Daniel himself gets directly a series of visions in Daniel chapter 7. Very different idioms, but the same content laid out. Again, all Gentile history. And commands our attention for that reason. And of course, Daniel upstages all these other advisors, so you can imagine how popular he was among those guys, right? And so they take an occasion, of course, to get Nebuchadnezzar on an ego trip, And Nebuchadnezzar's dream, of course, dealt with this big image. So they talk him into building one, all of gold. And you know the story of Daniel 3 and the fiery furnace. And you can read it. It's pretty straightforward. By the way, Nebuchadnezzar, I believe, was saved. I believe his testimony, where there's a chapter in the Bible written by a Gentile king. It's chapter 4 of Daniel, written by Nebuchadnezzar himself and published throughout the entire world. And it's his testimony. But be that as it may, Nebuchadnezzar eventually passes away. And after a couple of other episodes, the kingdom is split between two, a father and a son. The son is Belshazzar, a profligate son, who is running the kingdom at a time that another world empire is on the rise to the east, the Persians. The Persians make a coalition with the Medes. And there's a whole fascinating person in history by the name of Cyrus, how he rises to power by really shrewd effectiveness. And he has a general by the name of Ugubaru that is his shrewd maneuverer. And they are the threat to Babylon from the east. They knock off a few of the peripheral cities, which doesn't look that serious to Belshazzar, the then king of Babylon, but it does give them control of the canal system in Babylon, which was a major national asset. And while the Persians are a threat, Belshazzar is not only not preparing in his arrogance, he chooses to throw a party rather than get to military readiness. He should be sounding general quarters. Instead, he has a party. And he throws the very famous party that becomes a major, major event in world history. Part of the tone of the party was to show arrogance of all kinds, but especially the God of Israel. And he sends his messengers next door to the museum to get the temple vessels, and he uses the temple vessels in the party as a gesture of desecration. Now, what was going on outside the city is Ugubaru had sent one of his divisions upriver. And at a pre-appointed time, they diverted the Euphrates River into the canal system they controlled. And that caused the water levels of the river that supplied the moat around Babylon to drop. And the other divisions at the pre-appointed time went in under the gates and took over the city. One of the most incredible scenes in history, of course, is the famous scene during Belshazzar's party. Because while they're taking the temple vessels and having a big field day, I don't know how Cecil B. DeMille missed this for a movie. It'd be great. A hand, the fingers of a man's hand, started writing on the wall and wrote some cryptic letters. And that tended to put a kind of a gloom on the party, as you can imagine. And I love the King James in that place, as it says, Belshazzar's knees smote one against the other. In any case, it shook him up, and his advisors, the experts, came out, and they could not read the writing. And the queen, apparently the wife of Nebuchadnezzar, was still alive in those days, and she called his attention to the fact that there was a guy in Nebuchadnezzar's reign that had a gift for this sort of thing. And so they called Daniel out of retirement. Daniel comes in. They offer him all kinds of rich rewards. He says, keep yours, and gives a little eulogy, insulting the king and explaining how the predecessor, Nebuchadnezzar, now there was a king. And he goes through a little bit of that, which must have been very popular. But then he goes on to interpret the letters. And according to the Talmud, the reason he was able to interpret is that he read them vertically and backwards. But the net of it was, the net of that is that he says that your kingdom is weighed and wandering, your number is up, and this night is the kingdom delivered to the Persians. And I won't get through all the details or some puns and other things. But it's amazing, by the way, how many expressions in our language today come from that evening. Handwriting on the wall. Have you heard that expression? A lot of people use it, never heard, don't know where it comes from. Your number is up, right? And so forth. And all those things, there's about eight of them that come out of the Daniel chapter 5. But without getting into all that right now, of course, that night the Persians take over. But here is a key point that everybody misses, and it's vital to you and I. The Persians took over Babylon without a battle. If you visit the London Museum and see the Stele of Cyrus, which is a famous artifact, Cyrus himself on it by hand boasts that he captured the world at Babylon without a battle. There was no destruction of Babylon. There was a fall. It took 3 days for most of the residents to know that the city had been taken over by the Persians. They did not interrupt the temple services, the various things. Persians took over. They owned the place. It's a mix of trying to give you a little bit of history so you can interpret chapter 13, and yet, on the other hand, not spend too much time recapping a lot of history. But a couple other points I'd like to make that I think are interesting. Ugubaru, of course, takes over Babylon. It's, I think, 14 days later that Cyrus, the big boss, comes in and makes his appearance, takes over the city. And interestingly enough, we understand from the ancient records that Cyrus was presented the scroll of Isaiah in chapter 44 and 45. We'll get into this all in detail when we get to that part there. But the main point is in that portion of Scripture, there is a letter written to Cyrus by name. God says, because I'm calling you by name, even though you don't know who I am, you will thus know that I'm the God of Israel. And the scroll was written 150 years earlier. And by the way, the person, according to the, I think it's the Talmud, or Josephus, I forget which, that presents the scroll to Cyrus is none other than Daniel. And Cyrus is obviously impressed. I think we all would be, wouldn't you? Find a letter 150 years old calling you by name. And by the way, giving the highlights of your career and some other things. And so Cyrus is impressed. It's a matter of history that he is. And he releases the Jews to go home. Now, what's interesting about this is it's the very day, 70 days, that the captivity started. That's a whole study. But when you go through all that arithmetic, you discover it's the exact day. Now, there's another detail of all of this that I think is worth your consideration. There's a passage in Ezekiel, chapter 4, and for time reasons we won't go into all the details now, but the gist of it is that God says through Ezekiel that there will be 430 years of judgment on Israel. Now, 70 of those 430 years we know about. That's the Babylonian captivity. If you take 70 from 430, that leaves you 360 years of judgment predicted upon Israel, and those 360 years don't fit any particular passage of history. It's an awkward interpretive problem. It has been suggested by several that in Leviticus chapter 26, there's four different places where God says, in effect, that if you don't obey me the first time, I'll multiply your punishments by seven. Oh, another piece of history you need to have to get background here. When Nebuchadnezzar does his first siege, and he makes them all vassals of Babylon and takes some of them slaves, the prophets, that is, I should say, Ezekiel and Jeremiah, preach to the people that Nebuchadnezzar is the instrument of God, that this is God's judgment on the nation. The false prophets surrounding the leadership say, nonsense, we're God's chosen people and God's going to deliver us. And that was a more popular message. Jeremiah says, no, God has told me to tell you that don't expect to be delivered. You're in for 70 years of captivity. And by the way, if you don't yield, God is going to destroy Jerusalem. Well, to make a long story short, Joachim says, nonsense. He rebels. Nebuchadnezzar lays a second siege on Babylon, succeeds, replaces Joachim with Zedekiah, and goes back home. And again, Ezekiel from writing from Babylon and Jeremiah writing in Jerusalem tell Zedekiah, don't rebel against Nebuchadnezzar. He's the hand of God, in effect. They couldn't swallow that. They're Jewish. He's Gentile. God is going to deliver us and so forth. No. So they rebel also. And by this time, Nebuchadnezzar has a belly full of the whole operation. He sends his troops and not only lays siege, he levels the place, destroys Jerusalem, takes them all slaves. That's the third siege of Nebuchadnezzar. The reason I'm getting into these technicalities is, in the Old Testament, there are two phrases. One is, the servitude of the nation is to be 70 years long, and it was to the very day. It starts from the first siege of Nebuchadnezzar. There's also a phrase, and Daniel uses it and elsewhere, of the desolations of Jerusalem, and they were predicted by Jeremiah to be 70 years long. And because they both smack of the captivity and they're both 70 years long, most scholars treat the servitude of the nation and the desolations of Jerusalem as if they were synonyms. Now, the reason I'm getting into this is this peculiar passage, some, I guess, 10, 15 years ago, this peculiar passage of Ezekiel bothered me. The 430 years, less 70, the 360 years. And I ran into this idea that, gee, Leviticus says four times that if you don't obey me the first time, I'll multiply your punishment by seven. Well, if you multiply 360 by seven, you get 2,520 years. And several commentators have noted that that's about the duration of the diaspora. That is, from the Babylon captivity coming back, you know, by the time you go through Rome and the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD and all that, the Jews get scattered throughout the world. That's been roughly a little over 2,000, call it 2,500 years. Well, I'm always bothered by that. First of all, the whole link seemed a little contrived, but then also, there's nothing approximate in God's plan. If we're understanding correct, it's precise to the very day. But what no one had bothered to do was to take the 2,520 years and recognize that God deals in 360-day years for lots of reasons. Sir Robert Anderson discovered that and thus unraveled the Daniel 9, the 70-week prophecy of Daniel and all of that. But no one ever applied that here. So I thought, well, gee, what's 2,520 years... if you take 360-day years, the solar year, and that's the 907,200 days, and you say, Chuck, that's wonderful. What do I do with that? Well, what you need to do is say, okay, what's that in our calendar? Well, that means you've got the Julian year is about 11 minutes and 10.46 seconds longer than the mean solar year. And what that all means is you end up having three leap years too many every four centuries. So, and they recognized this in 1752 AD. They realized they had an 11-day error in our Julian calendar. There was 11 days too many, so they made the 3rd of September of 1752, the 14th of September. In other words, got rid of 11 days, so to speak. They also decided that 1700, 1800, and 1900 will be common years, not leap years. The year 2000 will be a leap year. But the point is, they corrected this minor anomaly in our leap year calculations to get the mean solar year in step with this idea of the year and all of that. Well, you say, gee, what do you do with the 2520 years? I mean, that's 907,200 days. How many years and days is that in our calendar? Well, it turns out that's 2,483 years, and you have to go through some corrections for the leap years. And without taking you through all of that, it turns out that the 2,520 years by multiplying it out becomes on our calendar 2,483 years, 9 months, and 21 days. And you say, gee, Chuck, that's really exciting. What do I do with that? Well, your next problem is, okay, when do you start counting? Well, it's interesting because the servitude of the nation started with the first siege of Nebuchadnezzar, and it lasted 70 years. But remember, those are 360-day years, so that's actually 69 years and 2 days. That means that that ended on July 23rd of 537 B.C. And if you count 2,483 years, 9 months and 21 days, from the servitude of the nation, Israel, you come to May 14th of 1948, the very day that David Ben-Gurion announced to the world that the new Jewish homeland was going to be called Israel, May 14th of 1948. All the arguments that we're still going through, I appear on KKLA and get into a talk show, and the amillennialists crawl out of the woodwork. You take the Bible literally. I says, I take the Bible seriously. And they didn't know how to deal with that one. But all those arguments should have ended on May 14th of 1948, because up till then you could argue this, that, and the other thing. But hey, Israel is. It's there. Go visit it. See it. Feel it. And they're going to start building the temple. Come on, get serious, gang. But that's interesting. I don't want to oversell this. The point is, that's an interesting situation. There are lots of controversies about the details I'm going through. I'm not boring you with all that stuff right now. But it's interesting, if you count this period of time that Ezekiel predicts from the servitude of the nation's completion, you come to May 14th of 1948. Okay. Well, what about these desolations of Jerusalem? Okay, well, that turns out that Jerusalem fell in 587 B.C., and you take your 69 years and 2 days after that, you get to August 16th of 518 B.C., and you add your 2,483 years, 9 months, and 21 days to that, and you come out to June 7th of 1967, the first day that Israel controlled the old city of Jerusalem since the crucifixion of Christ, the very day. And so that's kind of interesting. And I say, what a coincidence. And the rabbis say, coincidence is not a kosher word. Now, all this hangs around Babylon, Babylon captivity. The Babylon captivity ended by Babylon being conquered by the Medes and the Persians. But the fact, I'd like you just to trust me, is important, is that the Persians did not do it with a, they did not destroy the city. They conquered it. It became their capital. A couple of hundred years later, in Greece rises another young, promising, fantastic leader by the name of Alexander, who conquers the known world all the way to India. And I think, what was it, at the age of 29, he fell on his bed and wept because there were no more worlds he knew to conquer. Alexander the Great. What was his capital? Babylon. He conquered, you know, he conquered the Persians. Babylon was still a city. He was going to make it his primary capital. He had plans to make it a harbor with 1,000 ships. That's all the way up the Euphrates. That's a big deal. He passed away in Babylon. So it never got fulfilled. His four generals said on his deathbed, who did he give the empire to? He says, give it to the strong. Boy, what a dumb thing to do. So they spent the next century fighting over it, the four guys. The point is, Babylon was inhabited for several centuries, after the Persians, after the Greeks. In fact, even in 100 A.D., there are still merchants there, and there's a priestly school. Babylon atrophies. It disappears from prominence on the world scene because one of the four generals created a city called Seleucia, which was more closer to some trade routes, and because of its dominance, Babylon starts to decline, you know, in a merchant sense, and it erodes away from history. Well, I'll come to some of that. Let's get back to Isaiah and see how this all, why this is all so important to you and I. But the first thing we notice, that the burden of Babylon, Babylon's going to be destroyed here, but we notice, first of all, it says the tumultuous, in verse 4, the tumultuous noise of kingdoms of nations gathered together, plural, lots of them. some of the commentators as well, they were conquered by the Medes and the Persians, a coalition between the Medes and the Persians. And by the way, the Medes were allies of Babylon when they were against Assyria for a while, but the Medes and the Persians were against Babylon, conquered Babylon. And we're going to discover the Medes are going to surface in verse 17. I'll leave those remarks till I get there. Let's move on. My suggestion is these are kingdoms of nations. It's plural. I think it's more than just the Medes and the Persians personally, but we'll go on. The Lord of hosts mustereth the host of the battle. So this is God's hand in here. Verse 5, they come from a far country, from the end of heaven. Hey, come on, guys. Persia's next door. What do you mean the end of heaven? Something else is going on. Even the Lord and his weapons of his indignation to destroy the whole land. Now, up till now, it's just been suggestive. But the next few verses are going to remove all doubt as to this having happened historically. Verse 6, wail, for the day of the Lord is at hand. Wait a minute now. The day of the Lord, that's a familiar phrase to us students of the Old Testament. That's the day when God pours out his wrath upon the earth. That's the wrap-up. That's Armageddon. That's the close of the 70th week of Daniel. That's clearly yet future, as you'll see in a minute. So what Isaiah is talking about is never been fulfilled. This is not the fall of Babylon to the Persians. This is something else, yet future. Why am I making such a thing of this? Because the Bible requires the city of Babylon to be a major world power at the time of the end. Why is that meaningful to you and I? Because for 19 years, Saddam Hussein has been rebuilding the city of Babylon. The U.S. press does not have the biblical perception to understand its relevance. They think they're just some ceremonial buildings, and they're right, by the way. If you visited there, you'd probably be quite disappointed. There's some temples and some buildings, but it's not a big deal yet, but it is being rebuilt. Palace of Nebuchadnezzar has been rebuilt. Most of the major key temples have been rebuilt. The famous processional way has been rebuilt. And, you know, the point is it started. And the Bible, when you recognize that, you realize that these passages are not allegorical or symbolic. They're literal. Let's move on. See what else it says. Wail, for the day of the Lord is at hand. It shall come as a destruction from the Almighty. Therefore shall all hands be faint and every man's heart shall melt. And they shall be afraid. Pangs and sorrow shall take hold of them. They shall be in pain, like a woman that travaileth. There's that expression. Those of you that are students of prophecy, recognize that expression. That these judgments, these pains, come like labor pains. That sounds familiar to you from Matthew 24 and 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and elsewhere. A very common expression in prophecy dealing with the end time. They shall be amazed one another, the faces shall be as flames. Behold, there it is again. The day of the Lord cometh, cruel, both with wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he shall destroy the sinners out of it. Oh, really? Destroy the sinners out of it? That's interesting. You think that's interesting? Look at verse 10. For the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. The sun shall be darkened in its going forth. The moon shall not cause its light to shine. And we'll find out in verse 13 that the earth is going to be removed out of its orbit. Has that happened so far? Not so you'd notice. Verse 11, and I will punish the world for its evil. Wait a minute, I thought this was judgment on Babylon. The pride of the Chaldeans, this place on the plain of Shinar, 62 miles south of Baghdad. No, I will punish the world. God can't punish the world until he's ready to punish all of it. That's why Jesus Christ, when he opened his ministry, quoting Isaiah chapter 61, first two verses, stopped at a comma. I'll publish tidings and heal the sick and so forth. But he didn't go beyond the comma which said, on the day of vengeance of our God. God wasn't ready yet. Praise God. If he was, you and I wouldn't be saved. I punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will cause the arrogancy of the proud to cease and will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. Has that happened yet? Because I know a few he's missed. Verse 12, and I will make a man more rare than fine gold, than the golden wedge of Ephraim. It says here that the very existence of man will be threatened. Nowhere in history has the entire existence of the human race on the earth been threatened like it is today. Soviet Union submarines holding hostage 12,000 cities. We don't know where they are. They've got 64 Typhoon-class submarines, each one with 20 tubes, each missile with 10 independently targeted warheads, and no way to stop it. And that's just their side. Now, you put our side on that. We have about half as much, but enough. We only have 6,000 cities. Get serious, gang. Right now, today, as we talk, the world is in jeopardy. We tend to dismiss that with all the other euphoria because of the 100-hour war, wonderful, and there's all this peace and safety being talked about. 1 Thessalonians tells us about that. When they say peace and safety, then cometh sudden destruction. Move on, verse 13. Therefore, I will shake the heavens and the earth, and the earth shall remove out of its place in the wrath of the Lord of hosts in the day of his fierce anger. And it shall be like the chased roe, and like a sheep that no man taketh up. They shall every man turn to his own people and flee every one into his own land. By the way, that verse 14 is kind of a strange verse. It implies that some of the sheep have been taken up, some are left. So you can chew on that one. If you're pre-trib, you can jump on that one and say, ooh, great. But it's not conclusive. I just throw it as a side. But verse 15, everyone that is found shall be thrust through, and everyone that is joined unto them shall fall by the sword. The children also shall be dashed to pieces before their eyes. The house shall be spoiled, and their wives ravished. Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them, who shall not regard silver as for gold. They shall not delight it. In other words, the Medes are involved, but not for money, not for spoil. Now, because the Medes are mentioned in 17, many commentators assume that this refers to the Medes and Persians conquering Babylon in 539 B.C. Nonsense. No way has this happened in the past. You read the past, there's no way you can contrive this passage to have been fulfilled historically. It hasn't happened yet. What are the Medes doing here? Well, let's talk about the Medes a minute. Who are the Medes? The Medes were a nation in the western corner of Elam, Iran, Persia, and north, and also on the eastern edge of Iraq. You and I know the Medes as the Kurds. How do the Kurds feel about the Babylonians? Saddam Hussein used his chemical weapons on their women and children to make a point. His gas, their women and children, his point. But how do the Medes feel about Iraq? Doesn't take any insight to visualize, yes, indeed, they'll be stirred up against them, and not for silver or gold. The bow shall dash the young men to pieces. There's that word again, bows. Bows and arrows are King James English. The Hebrew word are launchers and missiles. Their bow shall dash the young men to pieces. They shall have no pity in the fruit of the womb, and their eyes shall not spare the children. Now, verse 19, and Babylon, the glory of the kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' excellency, is this mystical Babylon? Is this symbolic? Is this allegorical? No, it's the pride of the Chaldeans' excellency. Who was the Chaldeans? The people that dwelt in Shinar, the plain of Shinar. This is talking literal, traditional Babylon. How can it be? It's talking yet future. Babylon has to be rebuilt, and it is as we speak. And it shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. How did God overthrow Sodom and Gomorrah? Genesis 18 and 19. Fire from heaven. Now, geez, that missiles and nuclear weapon? Could be. I'm not going to push that point. The main point is it hasn't happened in history. Verse 20. After this happens, that Isaiah's talking about, it shall never be inhabited, neither shall it be dwelled in from generation to generation, neither shall the Arabian pitch tent there, neither shall the shepherds make their fold there. That's kind of interesting. Neither shall the Arabian pitch tent there. Babylon's got nothing to do with Arabia. Arabia's a long way to the south. How did Isaiah know that the Arabians would be a dominant factor in our day? That's kind of interesting in itself, isn't it? In any case, though, Babylon will never be inhabited. Has it been inhabited? Yes. When Kolduy, the famous German excavator in the turn of the century, excavated Babylon, he was able to hire Arabs from the four villages that sit there on Babylon. The village of Hilla had 10,000 occupants as late as the late 1800s. It was a. So this says it'll never be inhabited. That means the destruction it's talking about is yet future. But wild beasts of the desert shall lie there, their houses shall be full of doleful creatures. Ostriches shall dwell there, and there's some doubt about the translation. And the he-goat shall dance there. Now, the he-goats is a strange phrase because it also may mean demons. That's a whole side study. And the wild beasts of the coastland shall cry in their desolate houses, and the jackals in their pleasant palaces, and her time is near to come, and her days shall not be prolonged. And let's continue in verse 14 down to verse 11. We'll leave verse 12 on for a special study next time. We've got enough spooky stuff for one night.